I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library, and I appreciate all of you being here for our ongoing series on crime, grime, and slime. Hope you're all awake. For those of you who are here who are members of the family, I hope you checked your weapons at the door, as we're asking today. I want to mention a couple of upcoming programs before I introduce Bill Owsley. In what's left of the month of April, we still have some great programs. Monday night, tomorrow night, Tony Goldman, who is a developer from New York, who has developed a large part of downtown New York, Soho, et cetera, and also developed a substantial part of the Art Deco parts of Miami Beach, will be here talking about redeveloping the future. And that's, in essence, a sort of prelude to an ongoing series we have about we're calling What Makes a Great City, in which we'll bring some of the leading people from architects, urban planners, people who've written about cities, architectural critics like Paul Goldberger, The New Yorker, to Kansas City to talk about what makes a great city. And we hope develop some ideas for our city. And in fact, on May 25th, we'll have Edward Glaser. If you got our May calendar, which just came out, which has Tony Glaser's book, Triumph of the City, on the cover. He wrote this book. It's getting great reviews. He's the Glimp Professor of Economics at Harvard and the director of the Taubman Center for Local and Regional Governance. Anyway, that will be an ongoing series that I hope you all participate in, and Tony Goldman will be here at the Central Library tomorrow night. We're doing a lot on the Civil War, as well, as you're probably aware, ongoing series with the Command School at Fort Leavenworth on the great battles of the Civil War, a lot of other things. But in particular, I want to draw your attention to Tuesday, April 26th, again, here at the Central Library. David Goldfield will be here with his book, which is probably the most important book written at the time of the sequicentennial, the 150th anniversary that we're going through. It's called America Aflame, How the Civil War Created a Nation. And it's about the religious engagement of the Civil War, the origins of the Civil War, the intensity of the Civil War, and the results of the Civil War and its relationship to particularly evangelical religion in America. And this is, I'd say, of all the books written about the Civil War in the last few years, the book that's getting the most attention and looks like it may have created a new dialogue on the Civil War. And he'll be here on Tuesday the 26th. I want to mention two other things that are coming in May. For those of you who are interested in either baseball or true crime, we have the greatest commentator on baseball, particularly American League baseball, Bill James, our own Bill James from Lawrence, will be here. But he'll be here with a new book called Popular Crime, Reflections on the Celebration of Violence, and that's on Wednesday, May 4th, and that will be at the Plaza Library. And then last but not least, I do want to mention a guy who's written Harvard, member of the Harvard English Department, who's coming, Leo Damrosch, who's written, before this, he's written a very good book on Rousseau, the political philosopher Rousseau, but he's written what I think is the best short book, certainly in recent history, on Tocqueville and democracy in America, published last year, and he'll be here on May 10th, Tuesday, May 10th, here at the Central Library. So, a lot of stuff coming up. If you're not on our mailing list, we have cards that you can pick up, I think, in the front desk there, and you can get on our mailing list, and we'd be happy to tell you about all these things well in advance, what's coming up. But today, we have Bill Owsley, who is our resident expert, or at least was once the resident expert on crime in Kansas City, particularly the mafia, but lots of other things as well. In fact, Bill was responsible for putting away a couple of city council members. Are there any current city council members here? Stand up for your picture for the lamp. No, sorry. And of course he'll be talking today about his book Mobsters in Our Midst, on the Seville family. I did tell him that I was going to tell my one family mafia story. I was in my father's office one day when a reporter for the Star, and which reminds me, by the way, Star Books, my friend Doug Weaver is over here selling the book, and Bill will sign books. You can purchase the book over here at this counter in the South. East corner, and he'll be signing books after the presentation. But in any case, a Kansas City Star reporter calls my father up. I'm in his office, And the first question, my father puts him on speakerphone. He says, Mr. Kemper, can you tell me about your relationship to the mafia? It's hard to answer that question, right? And as it turns out, and you can read a lot about the larger subject here, the central bank of which my father was a shareholder, being on the east side, had a lot of loans to members of the family, including some installment loans of cars that got blown up in the River Market. And, which tells you a few things. One, this ever-enterprising star, there's kind of, some of the connections were a little loose there, I thought. But also, the power of the family may have already been diminishing if they had to buy their cars on the installment plan. Bill could tell you more about the whole story with the central bank, but I thought that was pretty amusing. He is our expert. He's written a previous book, very well received, I think a bestseller, at least in local terms, Open City, True Story of the KC Crime Family, 1900 to 1950. He was an FBI agent for 25 years and spent 20 of those years hunting down the bad guys here in Kansas City. And so it's a great honor to welcome back Bill Owsley, FBI.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that welcome, and I appreciate the opportunity offered to me by the library, Mr. Kemper, to spend another gloomy day here in Kansas City with you, talking about some of Kansas City's history. Let me start out by warning you that anyone that does not buy my book, I will know who you are. I have ways and means. Well, it was a early morning of June 6, 1950, when a passerby detected a water leak in the building housing the First District Political Club at 716 Truman Road. He took a peek in the window, didn't see anything, but still felt that it was worthy of calling the police. And the officer that responded found one of the two doors of the club was ajar, pushed it open, and peeked inside, and there was a body lying on the floor. He called the detectives. They came. They responded. They not only found the one body, but they found another one in a chair in a little office alcove of the political club. Both had been executed, shots to the head, multiple shots above the ear, in the forehead, typical gangland murder. So the police had a gangland execution on their hands. The victims were known as the two Charlies, Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargatta. The murders themselves transcended ordinary gangland killings. It set off a firestorm. It became the subject of national media attention. And right on the heels of the murder came a special investigating committee headed by Estes Kefauver, known as the Kefauver Committee, the first real committee of its kind to investigate organized crime in the United States, something that had basically been ignored, its existence denied. And, of course, they focused on the two Charlies, and it made the murder even more of interest nationally and all. Now, the question is, of course, why were these two murders of national interest? Well, Charlie Bonaggio had taken over the leadership of the Kansas City criminal organization, more commonly known as the Outfit. In the East Coast, they used that Cosa Nostra, our thing. And this is a part of our thing, but in the West, in Chicago and Kansas City and west of the Mississippi, it was the outfit or the clique. Now, Bonaggio had taken over leadership following the government's successful prosecution, conviction, and jailing of the boss of the Pendergast machine, Tom Pendergast, that had ruled this city for many, many years, and the then organized crime boss, Charlie Carolla. Now, thank you very much. I guess that's a sign to get off. I don't know. Bonaggio had taken over the leadership following the jailing of Pendergast and Carollo. Leadership in Cosa Nostra is as sure, the succession is as sure as it is for the Queen of England or the King of England. And it's one of the attributes that have made it a long-term problem. But anyway, Charlie, although he was the mob boss, was better known as a political figure. And that is a key factor in this whole story, going back to my first book, Open City, on through. Politics is the main artery of this story. We think of The Sopranos and The Godfather and shotgun murders and people in the trunk, and we perceive that to be organized crime. That's what it's all about. But it's really the main artery is politics. And Charlie became more important as a political figure than as the leader of the outfit. In fact, by 1942, Charlie Bonaggio, taking over the Pendergast machine, in a sense, or its place, so to speak, he was the most powerful, influential political figure in the state of Missouri. And as a result, sometimes it was overlooked that he had a second job. Now, by the way, not to sell him short, but Charlie Gargatta, the other Charlie, I should mention to you who he was. Charlie Gargatta rose in the outfit from way back in the 30s. He was a gunman, an enforcer, one of the few people ever caught in a gangland execution. The sheriff of the time, Tom Bash, came upon the scene of the murder of a fellow by the name of Ferris Anton, and a shootout incurred. And Bash had Gargatta in his sights, but he threw his gun down, and Bash said he didn't have it in him to shoot an unarmed man. Too bad, Tom. I think I would have taken a shot. But anyway, because this Gargatta was a vicious guy, and he rose in the outfit also, and he became Charlie Bonaggio's right-hand man, his protector, his constant companion. And he fell when his boss fell. Now, Charlie Bonaggio, under the cloak of his political situation, never forgot who he was. Number one, that he had the outfit's interest to further. Secondly, there was always the pressure behind these out front guys by some of the old time racketeers that were the pioneers of the family. These were guys they called the Mustache Petes. They were born in Sicily. They didn't speak English very well. They didn't mix very well. They were clannish. They were not the out front type of people, but behind the scenes, they were the power. People like Joe Scarface DiGiovanni and Big Jim Ballesteri. These were secretive, mafioso type people, throwbacks to the Sicilian mafia. in the way they handled themselves, in their protocols, in everything they did. So Bonaggio had others to answer to. And so he opted to use his political power to open the state to gambling. They wanted it to be like it used to be in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s when it was wide open gambling. And the mob was taking in millions of dollars. Everybody paid to be protected. And the political machine was there to assist the mob in protecting open gambling, open prostitution, narcotics. Anything went. In fact, it was an open city, under the complete domination and control of the Pendergast machine and their partners, the criminal organization. So he had to answer to these people, and so he was going to open the state of Missouri to gambling. And that's how he was going to use this political power. Now, in order to do that, he needed a war chest. As he told one politician, "I need a governor. I need a governor." And he went about trying to accomplish that. And what he did is he sold out, in a sense, by promising outside syndicate interests, including the infamous Frank Costello from New York, who was known as the prime minister of organized crime. He sold out to these national syndicate interests. "If you give me the money, I'll give you gambling and you'll share. And it'll be like it used to be, from St. Louis to Kansas City." Well, he took the money, and he didn't come through. And so Charlie Bonaggio had to go. And there was a great deal of suspicion, a great deal of speculation that these outside hitmen had come from Chicago or New York, these mysterious people, and had done the deed. Well, in fact, there's no murder out in Kansas City that's ever been done by an outsider. And that was a tradition. Something that was part of the family here. They could take care of their own business. And many, many years later, we intercepted a conversation that's in the book of Nick Civella plotting a murder and saying, "We have the best bloodhounds in the United States. We're the best at doing this." So there was speculation, but on the street, the word of those who knew placed the orchestration of the two Charlies on the back of a 38-year-old, practically unknown thug by the name of Nicholas Civella. Just 2 years prior to that murder, Nick Civella was spending time in Chicago in exile, having escaped an attempt on his own life. Nick had been a renegade in his early years. He didn't look up to these mob guys. He went his own way. And Big Jim Ballesteri was out to make him pay. This was not the first time he had to flee. He fled twice to Chicago to protect himself. So it was Nick Civella who was lolling away time in Chicago. How did he come to orchestrate the murder of these two prominent figures? Well, what had happened is Tony Gizzo, who was one of the most influential racketeers of the time, had been persuaded to bring Nick back to guarantee him safe passage. And so he acceded to the request. He brought Nick back. And in the world of organized crime, he put him on the one sure career path. He made him his chauffeur. Most chauffeurs end up being bosses somehow. That's the career path. So Nick comes back. Nick comes back and is taken under Tony's wing. He's his chauffeur. And So when he spoke for Gizzo. And with that, his responsibilities increased, his stature increased. People had to listen to this guy now because he was Gizzo's man. And Gizzo, being the most prominent person in the city, even really beyond Bonaggio, because Gizzo was Ballesteri's man, and Ballesteri was the voice. So at times it was Gizzo who overrode some of the edicts that came out from Bonaggio. So Gizzo was really another of the secretive powers. So when it came time that the two Charlies had to go, he would be the one that was responsible. And as it turned out, this 38-year-old person who was a nobody up until this time turned out to be far more astute, far more organizational, far sharper than his boss, Tony Gizzo. And he had his ear. And therefore, the story came out that it was Nick who orchestrated that murder. And with that, of course, a deed such as that, in this world, your stature grows. And now Nick, an unlikely story to ever become anybody, was on the cusp of taking over leadership of the organization. All that had to happen, which did, is Tony Gizzo passed away of a heart attack in April of 1953. And Nick was well situated at that time to take over the reins of the family, and his reign would last for 30 years, longer than anybody else in this secretive world of Cosa Nostra. Now, what I'd like to tell you very briefly is what did Nick Civella inherit here? Well, what he inherited was an organization that had its beginnings in the 1900s with the influx of the Italian immigrants from southern Italy and Sicily. Amongst those hardworking people, honest people, people who came here for a better way of life, for their life in Sicily was akin to slavery. But amongst them were the predators. Amongst them were those who were mafia connected, those who thought they were mafia connected, but all of whom had lived under the rule of the mafia. And the mafia in Sicily at that time was the government. So even the people who had no connection had lived under the mafia reign. And so there was what I like to call the mafia mentality. They figured these people would be with them forever. And so when these predators did what they knew best, bringing a new form of crime to this country, they became mafioso in kind. Now, let me make it clear. The mafia exists in Sicily. It was not transported like a burger franchise to the United States. These were simply people who practiced what they knew best from the old country. That's how they knew crime was to be done. And so what they did, as they did in the old country, they began by extorting their own people. And it was called the Black Hand Era. They sent these letters with the Black Hand on it demanding money. From these small factions, there was no organization yet. There were wannabes, there were real mafia types, there were all sorts of people who thought they could get in on the action. So there wasn't a family yet. That came with the passage of the Prohibition Law, a law that was well-meaning, well-intentioned, but had only one effect. It created organized crime. They couldn't have done it better themselves. Now, with Prohibition, now they had a product that was in demand nationally. They had a product they knew something about, making illicit liquor and beer and wine and what have you. And they jumped in with both feet. Still, they were factions. But they understood business, too, these people. They understood a number of things from the old country. Business, over there it was rural, but over here they could see the wealth of this new country. They understood that, and they understood politics. Because early on, that North End segment belonged to Tom Pendergast and his political machine. It was his people who ruled the North End. And they used the Italians as they used the Irish and all those under their domain, giving them and taking from them. And the people who the political machine allied themselves with was the criminal element. And this happened all over the country. Political machines everywhere did the same thing. You scratch my back, I scratch yours. Simply, you keep me in office, and I'll protect your operations. It was a corrupt operation, and around the country, politics was very corrupt. There were machines, as I say, everywhere doing the same thing. So who would they go to control the Italian element but Big Jim Ballesteri and the Gigiovannis? Because they were, besides being criminals, they took that other aspect from the mafia culture, and that is they were societal people. You went to them for favors. You went to them to get anything done you needed done. You didn't go outside the North End. As in Sicily, you didn't go outside Corleone or whatever city. It was the Mafia Don who ruled. So way back then, the political alliance began. Now, moving ahead quickly, during Prohibition, these factions understood that good economy, good business meant we worked together because they had been knocking each other off. They had been losing money. There was price wars on the liquor, and so they decided to come together in what was called the Sugar House Syndicate. Sugar because it was the main ingredient, and they controlled all the sugar houses. So pretty soon they were able to dominate the bootleg booze industry, and they consolidated in 1926-27, and that, ladies and gentlemen, was the birth of the Kansas City crime family. Now, moving ahead quickly, politics being the artery of this whole thing, Johnny Lazzia, the out front boss, fronting for Ballesteri and DiGiovanni, decided that the Pendergast people shouldn't rule the North End politically, we should. They knew it. They knew that it was the stepping stone to power. And so Lazzia took over the North End apparatus, went up to 19th and Maine, and made Tom Pendergast an offer he couldn't refuse. We're partners now. We're partners. We'll take care of all these criminal activities, and you will share in it. We will keep you in office, and you will protect us, and we will all laugh our way to the bank. And that's what happened. The final nail in the coffin for this city was in 1931 when the Supreme Court decided that the Board of Police Direct Commissioners would be chosen locally and not by the state. So they handed the police department to the Pendergast machine and the organized crime family. John Lazzia officed at the police department in the chief of police office. He answered the phone. He made policy. He hired officers. He hired a police chief that had been selling used cars. The city was thrown wide open, as I described. wide open. This was the height of the criminal organization in this city. And they rode that wave until 1939, when the government finally interceded. Elections had been a nightmare in this city. Bloody elections, vote fraud, ghost voters, whatever you can think of, whatever bag of tricks, whatever it took, the elections were fixed, and the candidates of the machine were the ones that won. And among those candidates was a fellow by the name of Harry Truman. That was his path, his career path. So we're talking about an exceptional period in this city's history. The city became internationally known for its vice and corruption. Now, also what happened in this very active period in 1931-32, there was an uprising in New York among the families that had grown in that city, similar to Kansas City. If you were to take this dynamic and look at Cleveland and Detroit and Pittsburgh and Boston and New York and all, it was basically the same developmental stages that I described to you. The beginnings of a family, they tie up with the politicians, the whole thing. So in these various cities were these groups that were so similar, and they had contacts with each other. Some of it was just from the old country, people that were from the same province. Other connections came through prohibition. But these people all knew each other, but there was no national organization. Well, in 1931-32, there was an upheaval in New York called the Castelmarese War. Two main figures went at it, and as the result of that war, there came to be the national organization known as La Cosa Nostra. 26 families at that time were brought together, and a structure was put together, a ruling commission, definition of the family structure, a boss, an underboss, a counselor, a captain, and the soldiers, and all of this a structure that no other form of criminality in the United States had. It was a very formidable and different crime situation. So in 1953, when Nick took over, that's what he took over. This long-standing criminal organization with rules and regulations and codes and what have you that they had to follow. He was an inheritor of a criminal dynasty. And along with it, when he inherited all of their assets and all of what they controlled. Now, although it was in that context that he took over, that heyday was well done. It would be a far different culture that Nick Civella had to operate in. He would not have the benefit of a community, of a culture, of a nation that denied the existence of organized crime. He did not inherit a family that had no fear of how they operated, of going to jail, of anything as it was in the old days that would threaten their existence. Now, there were good times and bad times, but they survived them all. In 1939, following that prosecution, the reformers moved in, and they had to submerge. They had to go underground. And that's what Bonaggio was working at, to bring that back to the heyday. But they survived that. They survived it. So Nick was coming into a far different culture, and the reason was he had become a star. He came a star as a result of a gangland meeting in a little town in upstate New York where the board of directors of Cosa Nostra met. It was broken up by an alert state police, and Nick and Joe Filardo, another local figure here, had been captured in a cab fleeing the scene, and now he was a national and local star. Not only that, but this would be the beginning of the government's creaky, sleepy machine finally coming to life. It could no longer be ignored that there was such a thing. We couldn't bury our heads in the sand anymore. We could not let an event like the Kefauver Committee that blew organized crime out of the box and then everybody went to sleep. That wasn't going to happen anymore. And so the government, the legislatures, politicians, local entities, state entities, all entered the fray. This was now going to be a priority. Organized crime was recognized finally for what it was. And so this was the beginning of the FBI's organized crime program. Mr. Hoover said that there will be such a program. It began, and it continued on for many, many, many years. In fact, it was something that Civella was not used to having to contend with. There had been government interventions in the past, but then they went away, and it was all cool again. But in this case, the FBI was in it for the long run, as was the local police, the state police, and other entities. So Nick now had to operate on a different level. He was battered by grand jury appearances and all sorts of other problems to the point that he had to start to remove himself from the day-to-day activity. Couldn't be like the Lazio era when politicians and gangsters walked arm in arm and everything was out in the open. He now had to take a different tact. And, of course, this in itself would prove to be a detriment to the operation of the family. But Nick Civella was what he was. Cosa Nostra was what it was. And despite it all, he persevered. And although on one side of the coin he had problems, on the other side of the coin he was prospering. He had political clout here. He simply was not out front anymore. So that political clout was always in his corner. It helped him through many, many problem areas, one of which was to continually deny the existence of what Civella was and that there was a crime family here. And the other thing that he prospered from was his intimidation and takeover of a Teamster official by the name of Roy Lee Williams. Roy Lee Williams started out here as put in place by Jimmy Hoffa to run the two most powerful locals. Nick Civella had long been after the Teamsters and had made inroads. But it was about this time that Jimmy Hoffa was taking over the Central States Pension Fund, lending money to people who bought establishments in Las Vegas as front men for the mob and then stole the money out of those casinos as skim. Nick wanted in on that. Nick wanted a piece of that action, and Roy was a little reluctant. So on one particular night, as Roy left the union meeting, these two thugs said, "Not that car, Roy. You're going to go in this car tonight." They blindfolded him, took him somewhere he would never know where it was. He walked into this darkened arena, and all that he saw was a stool sitting in the middle of this arena with a spotlight on the stool. And they sat him on that stool, and a voice out of the dark told him, "You will cooperate with Nick Civella. You will do what he says. You will follow his lead. And if you don't, we will kill your wife and your daughters, who they named by name and age, and you will be the last to go. Are there any questions?" So Nick Civella now had Roy Williams entirely in his pocket. He had cooperated with him before, but this was big time now. And interestingly enough, it was politics once again. Because the way Roy and Nick initially met was that they sat on an ad hoc committee, political committee, that reviewed the various political factions' candidates, decided who had the best chance to win, and then went about trying to convince the factions to come together and support that candidate. So that candidate, of course, owed various people, including Nick Civella. So it was the beginning of a relationship that was culminated with that stool and that light in that unknown location. Now Nick would ride Roy Williams to national prominence. So, as I say, he came at a bad time. He was facing challenges that he had never faced before, but this was the family. And one of the protocols of La Cosa Nostra is that they were in it for the long run. This was not a gang. This was not a group of people or an organization where the leader goes to jail or is killed and the body decays and dies. This is an organization with structure and protocol and rules to enable it to overcome any obstacle and any change in their culture or in what they had to face. So despite this all, he was in it for the long run, but as I say, so were we. And in the beginning, we had a gun with no bullets in it. We had an organized crime program, but very little to work with, because there had never been any laws enacted directed at criminal activity on the scale of Cosa Nostra. That had to come, and it would come, because finally the machinery was in gear and it was running smoothly. And so the laws came, and our programs prospered. People were going to jail. We were making cases, loan sharking, stolen property, extortion, infiltration of business. However, it was the mainstay of the criminal organization here, gambling, that eventually jumped up and bit Nick in the rear. We were able to make a case on an interstate gambling enterprise run by the outfit. They controlled all bookmaking operation in the city. When you have a crime family and you have criminal activity, they will control it. They are the monopoly. So Nick was now tied up in an indictment, and through manipulations and sharp lawyers and money that they had to spend, it took 7 years from the date of the indictment that Nick saw the inside of a jail. And during that period, the 1970s, 80s, was a time in Kansas City that rivaled the old days in the way of violence, warfare within the family, bodies in the trunk, buildings exploding, and what have you. So what Nick had to deal with in this period were things like the River Key, an establishment that was to be the highlight of the city turned into a war zone, turned into a blight on the city. And it was the genesis of so much other trouble that emanated out of the River Quay. It was a time of the mob attempting to do what they do best, and that is to enforce discipline by way of murder. But this time there was a problem in that the FBI and the police were interjecting themselves into these plans because we were hearing about the murders, warning the individuals they'd be murdered, doing two things, making it very difficult to kill them and turning these people against the family. Never before had there been a real threat to the welfare of the Sabellas and their people. Now they had a threat. They tried to kill a guy by the name of Sonny Bowen, a jewel thief. And we warned Sonny Bowen, so they couldn't trap him. And he turned, and we believed he killed one of theirs. They tried to kill a guy by the name of Carl Sparrow. And we went to him and warned him. And that led to a rebellion by Sparrow Brothers and their faction that became a continual thorn in the side of the Sabellas. And the machinations and the manipulations between the two factions trying to kill each other is the core of my book, as is the River Quay and these other acts of violence, how they all mesh. Because you see, when you're dealing with organized crime on the Cosa Nostra level, it's 1,000 stories within a story. The interrelationships, they have so many irons in the fire that these things all mesh. And when things start to unravel, there's a story here and a story there and an offshoot here, and people are being killed for one reason. So it was a time of severe problems for the outfit, and of course for law enforcement, we had our hands full. And to wrap this up, because there were so many other problems, one of which was Nick's health. It caused him to move away from the everyday leadership of the family. And it was that leadership was placed in the hands of his brother, Cork. Cork was a violent type. Nick was a reasonable type. Cork had a short fuse. Nick was deliberative. Cork was everything his brother wasn't. And maybe that's why Nick was the boss for so many years. But blood is thicker than anything else. So when Nick had to step aside to take care of his health, he put it in the hands of his brother. And his brother's answer generally was violence. And so this permeated this entire time. Now, the roundup, or the final roundup for the family, came when we were seeking evidence of these murders. We put a microphone in a restaurant where these people met, hoping to gain evidence of their plans and of what they had done previously in killing people and blowing up buildings. And we happened upon a conversation, not about murder, but they were discussing their interest in Las Vegas. Now, this is something we had known about for years. As I mentioned, we knew Hoffa and the fund was infiltrating Vegas. Very hard to prove. But now we had a seed. We had a seed to begin with, this conversation. And from that day in 1978, for the next 5 years or so, this case blossomed. And it continued to blossom. And now agents in Las Vegas, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Cleveland, in San Diego, this case had no boundaries as it spread out. And as we plotted along, We had electronic surveillance everywhere. The evidence was overwhelming. Two trials resulted, and it represented the demise of the crime family in the sense of the power, the assets, the influence, the impact on the city. There were those who would try to continue in the tradition, and they did for a while, and they may still today. But they're no more now than a loose-knit, I don't want to call them a gang, but a loose-knit group that have very few bullets in their gun. So it was a long, hard journey, but the ending was worth it all. Now, if you have any questions, yes, ma'am. Sir, I can't see it. I don't have an hour, do I, for that? He asked about any comments about the mafia attorney, Oscar Goodman, who only in America is now the mayor of Las Vegas. Oscar Goodman, who said he would rather have his daughter marry Tony Spilotro, a Chicago murderer, than an FBI agent. I don't need to say any more than that. He is what he was, a mob mouthpiece, more than an attorney. Yeah, yes, sir. Did Nick Civella have any children is the question. No, he didn't. Carl Civella, his brother, had children, one of which was Anthony Civella, who was a main player. And Anthony had a whole bunch of kids. But Nick himself and his wife had no children. So any stories about anyone dating Nick's children, it ain't going to wash. Over here. Yes, sir. Try to make that question briefer.
Bill.
Yeah. The question had to do with Carlos Marcello, the boss of New Orleans, and Joe Ayupa, the boss of Chicago, and their attempts using Nick Civella to get the benefit of Teamster, what was it, the... an insurance scam. Well, first of all, Marcello was was the subject of an undercover operation, and that was an independent investigation from us. We didn't have anything to do with it. But to answer your question very simply, Nick Civella had risen to the stature that anything from any crime family anywhere that touched on the Teamsters' central pension fund, their welfare fund, their insurance fund, anything up there, he would be included. He would be contacted because they needed his assistance. So when I came here, I thought he was a nobody. We thought this family was not very big. When I left, I found out that he was national impact. And that would be the reason, because of his influence over Roy Williams and what he could accomplish up there, his association and closeness to IUPA, who they respected Nick greatly, he would be consulting. Yes, sir. Question is about the other families around the country not respecting Kansas City, was it a subterfuge when, in fact, Nick was pretty important? You know, I think a lot of that had to do, and let me tell you a quick story, and I think it sums up what may have happened with these other families. When Joseph Valachi, the first turncoat, whoever revealed the secrets of the mob in the Congress, he was called to testify. It was gripping testimony. The country all tuned in. It was fantastic. And on this one occasion, they asked him a question. The senator from Omaha asked him a question about the situation in Omaha. And Valachi leaned over to his attorney, and they whispered back and forth. And, you figured, geez, this is something. Maybe this is something he's afraid to talk about, and all that. And he came back after consulting with his attorney, and he said, "Senator, where the hell is Omaha?" So I think that, that may have played a role in this. Midwest, even the FBI in Kansas City at one time was considered, we're out in the sticks. Yeah. I've been on 60 Minutes once. No movies. I'm still waiting. Any agent? I can play myself. Yeah.
At what point in time did they actually dissolve your group that worked so hard to bring the family down? That's the first part of the question. Did they actually dissolve it? And are we to understand that any remnants left these days are just being watched by local police and law enforcement?
A unit? Yeah, the question is the organized crime squad that I supervised, and was it dissolved? Well, it remained in place here for several years after I retired, and they did good work through the 90s. But the way the Bureau operates is as the impact and the necessity to assign agents is reduced, then they have to review whether this squad is really necessary. And I think the squad was basically, over time, reduced in numbers. And what there is today, I don't know. Now, I know in some big cities like New York, where there are still factions that are operative, I'm sure they still have an organized crime program. But the fact that the emphasis has been reduced is indicative of the fact that the family is not of the great importance and danger to this country. Yeah.
How and when did Camarillo not being a family, did he get incorporated with
Nick? Pete Tamborello, how did he get to a position in the family? He was Nick's first cousin, and whether he was ever initiated into the family, they do that. Then you become a formal member. That's part of the protocol. I don't know that he was ever what they call a made member, but he became Nick's right-hand man and driver and confidant in the sense they trusted him. He was a relative, and as a result, he was prosecuted as part of the Las Vegas case. He had the credentials. Yes, ma'am. How much influence over the mob and Harry Truman? Well, Truman is a real dilemma. I don't think it's black or white. There's gray in there. But I think basically Truman was a product of the Pendergast machine, but he never was totally and fully corrupt. Maybe that wasn't a way to say that. Let me rephrase that in saying that he did things to get where he was that he himself, as I outline in my book, in his diary, regretted. He regretted greatly what he did. But he did what he did, and he got to where he was, and he was loyal to Pendergast to the very end. He politically opposed the Kefauver Committee and anything that would make the Democrats look bad. So in that regard, you know, it's gray. But he was never in their pocket. In the back. The question is the witness protection program and the need for it being readdressed and how it operates, because as he mentioned, Freddie Bonadonna was a victim of the key in the sense that he was extorted. They tried to kill him. They killed his dad. It was one of the explosive parts of this history. Freddie went into the witness program, and it was awful. They didn't give him any documents. They didn't help him. What he was supposed to get, he never got. And it probably had something to do with his apparent eventual suicide in his relocated area. We were after the Marshal Service all the time about it, especially in Freddie's case. Whether they have improved it at all, I really don't know. But it certainly needed improvement at that time. I think it had been improving somewhat in the sense that they were taking it more seriously, but in the sense of, to the marshals in the beginning, these people were a burden. They were a burden. And as a result, you know, but I've had a recent conversation with Freddie's widow, and it's still a little bit crazy what they do. Yeah. Two more questions. Who have I got over here? Go, yeah, in the back. Well, first he killed a lot of people, and then he became the street boss. He was elevated to the street boss. He was Nick's successor. Would have been Nick's successor. He became an integral part of everything that went on. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, the question is about the Pendergast era surviving the Great Depression beyond other cities, and that's a fact. That's a fact. For one thing, you know, they had millions of dollars coming in from the criminal organization, and so that was something that not everybody had. Secondly, the Pendergast machine was such, and its power was such, that it was able to take the place of many welfare programs that were not available other place. He had the ways and the means and the clout and the money that this city was able to survive the Depression much better than anywhere else.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill. As Crosby said earlier, Mobsters in Our Midst is for sale today, courtesy of Kansas City Star Books. It's right around this side over here. Today and only today, it's $5 off. So we'll see you next time.